This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome back to our third session here this afternoon. We do hope that you're enjoying today. It's a very special time for not only horse racing, but the culture of Australia and building up to this magnificent event, the 150th Melbourne Cup. The next four guests, very important people like everyone that's been a part of our symposium today. And the theme is, what does the Melbourne Cup mean to you? What has the Melbourne Cup done to your life, basically? And at the conclusion here, towards the end of this particular session, we'd invite your questions too. We'd like you to have the chance to shoot a question to any of our panellists who are about to join us. Can I please introduce them to you? First up on my left, in red, is a lady whose life has been changed forever back in 1999 with the win of Rogan Josh. Bart Cummings got his 12th Melbourne Cup. And would you please make welcome Wendy Green. Alongside Wendy is a lady who absolutely etched her way into the history books and into the great record of the Melbourne Cup, preparing the Melbourne Cup winner back in 2001, the champion mare Ethereal. The trainer is Sheila Laxon. And the great horse trainer Etienne Demester prepared Archer to win the first two Melbourne Cups, and he won five of the first 18, and he was an outstanding trainer way, way back. He's not here today, but his grandson is Mark Demester joining us. And alongside Mark is a gent who you've seen earlier bring in the Holy Grail, the Melbourne Cup, but he's had the unique experience of winning two Melbourne Cups. A champion jockey, now retired, but one of the all-time greats and a wonderful ambassador for the Melbourne Cup and for racing, Johnny Letts. So, Wendy, over to you. I remember in 1999, after the win of Rogan Josh, the headline was Wendy in Wonderland. Tell us about the experience of owning a cup winner.
Am I on mic?
Certainly.
So
are.
I can talk without having to have anything in my hands. That's great. In 1999, I was fortunate enough, under the guidance of a wonderful jockey called John Marshall and a fantastic magician called Bart Cummings, to beat the Godolphin Stable with a horse called Rogan Josh. And on that day, I certainly, and I think Bart Cummings as well, certainly dobbed me Wendy in Wonderland. I think at the time you don't realise that it's going to be that different tomorrow. I had won races before, and I can say that the feeling on the day was the same as if I'd won a race at Birdsville. However, the prize was a lot bigger. That didn't come for ages. That turned up in the post, in my letterbox, over $1 million a few weeks later. So on the day, Brian, I can honestly say I was bewildered. My second day at Flemington, my first day had been on Derby Day on the Saturday, where we'd won also. So I was probably thinking that this was a bit of a habit. And it wasn't really until the week after that the whole implication of what it meant to become part of a dream and to join that exclusive club called the Melbourne Cup Winners Club, that I really realised, you know, what an impact the Melbourne Cup was having on my life, and indeed what it meant to the rest of Australia as I travelled home with a cup in the back of my car and confronted the people who were the people who stopped on that day. I confronted the people and said, Wendy, is this a cup? This is the story of what it means to be an Australian.
You should tell our audience also that in driving back from the Melbourne Cup, you're driving to Darwin.
That is correct.
There's no further point to drive to.
No, no.
And you, in the back of the car, you had the Melbourne Cup.
This is correct, yes.
How many stops do you reckon you made?
I think probably along the way there was about seven stops when we've counted back on it. And I think the number of people was a lot more than seven. I think that I never realised that... I'd come from Melbourne, from the glamour and from the Moe and from the fashions on the field and all these glamorous ladies. And, you know, I'd heard stories about people dancing on tables at Maxim's in Toorak And I was sort of a bit tempted there at one stage because I thought that was what one did when one won a Melbourne Cup. And it was wherever we went as a family that week, we were celebrated. And people are saying, but, you know, how can an unlikely horse from Western Australia, how can unlikely, very naive people like yourselves almost dare to bring a horse across the Nullarbor to Melbourne and race in Melbourne? You know, and I should have twigged then that that was really what people were dreaming about all over the country, but what people had never really believed could come to fruition. And so off we set out going home after this magnificent week in marvellous Melbourne. And we thought that was it. We thought we'd get home and life had settled back into what it had always been. You know, Mrs. Green, the school teacher. Although, you know, I had this new title, Wendy in Wonderland. And that in itself was another wonderful thing. Because just before that, my son had come home from school and he said, how many dads have I got? And I said, only one. And he said, why? And he said, well, it's not fair because the teacher at school said that, you know, my friend, he's got two dads and another one had three dads. And that not to worry about that, that that made them very special people. I'm digressing a bit here. After the Melbourne Cup, Geoffrey's teacher called me in and said, I know we've had this father discussion, but Geoffrey now claims he's got three mothers. He's got Wendy in Wonderland, Mrs. Green, the teacher, and Mum. So I suppose that was a big change too. But back going home, you know, and it was that whole empty continent thing. You know, we knew that we had to travel all those miles back and we knew that it was going to be a long road, but we knew we had this cup and we knew that we had lots and lots of stories to talk about. And the bush radio went ahead of us, the bush radio meaning the ABC talkback show of a night time, the policemen, the northbound coach lines, the truckies that went ahead of us. And I can tell you ghost stories that would make the hair on the back of your neck stand up, but we'll get to that some other symposium. And people would say, or, you know, can you stop at this truck stop, or can you stop at this pub, or can you stop by this letterbox? There's a man coming in from the station. And at first we were really puzzled by this. We didn't understand why we should stop. But the message that came back from that loud and clear was that suddenly a real Melbourne Cup hadn't disappeared up a sheik's skirt and hopped on a helicopter in the middle of the infield and gone somewhere else. Or, you know, it was a cup in the outback of Australia, travelling through the centre of Australia, and people wanted to see it. People wanted to know if it was ours to keep, if they could touch it. You know, it wasn't in a museum. And so we started to stop. And I think it was at Coober Pedy where I really had an epiphany, if you like. It came to my mind that it was definitely the race that stopped a nation, but much, much more than that. And when I spoke to these immigrants from Eastern Europe that had come here after the war, they'd and very hard-working, wonderful, old, dignified men who'd worked every day of their life, they told me the story, their story, of being an immigrant in a land of the fair go. And the Melbourne Cup, a cup that gave everyone a fair go, defined the ethos that they believed in so passionately. And to touch that cup, I'm getting a bit passionate now too. Better stick to being a passion fruit today. And what they said was, you know, that to touch it was to make a link, a tangible link with a symbol of that identity. And it just blew me out of the water.
We'll come back to hear more about the origins of the horse out of WA. But Sheila, I'd love to pose a couple of questions to you. You mentioned earlier, as a young lady, you came out from the UK and first stop was here in Canberra.
It was indeed. And in fact, I understand this is used to be the Canberra Hospital here, and that's where I worked. So my very first stop was in Canberra and worked in Canberra Hospital for 3 months.
You were born in Wales?
I was.
Yeah, and you actually got a licence to drive double-decker buses in England, is that right?
Yes.
And are involved in horses all the way through your life?
Yes. Mum used to have the beach ponies come to our place for the winter holidays. And so we learned to ride on them, and they were very naughty. We didn't have saddles or anything posh like that, so we learned to ride bareback, and they'd buck us off or roll on the grass to get us off. And that was a very good grounding of learning how to read horses and outsmart them.
It's quite unique what you've achieved in winning the Melbourne Cup, of course, as a trainer and the first official trainer, female trainer of the Melbourne Cup winner. You were in another life married to Laurie Laxon, who prepared Empire Rose. So the husband and wife are both trained at the Melbourne Cup winner.
Yes, and 13 is very significant, and it's 13 years since Empire Rose won the Cup when Ethereal won the Cup. So that was another significant 13 on my way through to the Melbourne Cup.
What did what was the first contact, or what was your first sort of inkling about this this great race, this iconic event here?
Well, would you believe, I was talking to somebody horsey when I arrived in Canberra, and he was going on about this Melbourne Cup, and I must have looked a bit, what's he talking about? And I had been involved with racehorses in England to some extent, but hadn't heard of the Melbourne Cup. And he was, I think his amazement that I'd never heard of it made me recall that, yes, I remember that day. I hadn't heard of the Melbourne Cup, and he just could not believe that someone didn't know about the Cup. And then there you go, so many years later, it became a real significant part of my life. But his horror, you can't mean that. You really can't mean that. And I think it was his reaction that made me think that this must be a pretty special race.
The mare Ethereal came through and won the Queensland Oaks. You brought the horse from New Zealand. You travelled over from New Zealand. Won the lead up to the Queensland Oaks. So she really was a star three-year-old at that time of the year here in Australia, up in Brisbane. You then set the horse on a Caulfield Cup course originally. Was the Melbourne Cup always on the radar, or was it just the Caulfield Cup?
Well, she had been nominated for the Melbourne Cup, so I guess that was also a possibility. But I know after she won the Caulfield Cup, the owners were very adamant they weren't going to carry on to the Melbourne Cup, and they wanted to set her for the Hong Kong Cup, which her mum had won some years previously. And if that's what they wanted to do, that's owner's privileges. But when I started working her after she'd had a day or two off after the Caulfield Cup, she was so incredibly well. And I remember talking to Peter and I was saying, look, I really think you should consider the Melbourne Cup. She's just bounced out of her skin. She feels fantastic. Don't you talk to me about that. We're going for the Hong Kong Cup. Mm-hmm. And so from there on in, it was my game plan to be able to change his mind.
And it rained through the night before that cup in 2001. Was that going to play into your hands?
Well, not really. She won the Oaks on a very good track, and I did think that she needed fairly good footing to see her best. And the Caulfield Cup was, I think it was just a slow track. It was, and compared to New Zealand standards, it was probably a good track. I was really happy with her on the morning. I took her out for some exercise, and I came back thinking, she's never been better, she's got to give it her best shot today. And that's when I heard that it had been raining down there all the time, and it was quite wet. And I must say, I was very anxious about whether she'd handle the distance on a wet track. And I did go into the race feeling quite pessimistic about her chances, I must say.
When did you realise that she was a real winning chance?
When Scott just straightened up, just sat there, gives the slip, it's gone. And next minute I just see him go, and she wins. But when I saw the replay, I thought, how could I have been so confident? It wasn't that much in it.
Extraordinary win. Mark, it's fantastic to have you, the grandson of Etienne Demester, who in the initial years of the Melbourne Cup, going back 149 years, he etched a sort of place in Cup history akin to Bart Cummings, winning the first two with Archer. The first question I've got to ask you, can you just lay to rest, did the horse walk to Flemington or to come by ship?
No, the horse was shipped to Sydney and then put on another ship and then shipped through to Melbourne. Now, Archer never walked to Melbourne, although I believe some of Etienne's other horses did. And history shows that they walked horses from Sydney down to Nowra, and on a few occasions they sent them by train out to Liverpool and then walked them down to Nowra. You'd wonder why, wouldn't you, sort of sending by train to Liverpool. And... Yeah, so no, that's a myth. And Andrew sort of alluded to it today, and you quizzed me last night about it.
First two cups, 61 and 62, beat the same horse both years.
Sorry?
That Archer beat the same horse both years in 61 and 62?
Yes, it was the same. Sorry, I didn't...
Yeah, the horse who ran second both
oh,
years.
Oh, did it? Yeah. Yeah. I'm not, yeah.
Now, what happened in 1863?
Well, 1863, Etienne sent his application or his nomination in to the VRC, or to the committee as it was then, and it arrived on a Wednesday, and the Wednesday was a public holiday in Melbourne, and the Succession Day, I think it was, but only the Melbourne people, only the Victorians knew it was a public holiday. So his application was looked at the next morning, and the stewards said, no, it's too late. We won't accept him. And he was favourite to win. So all the Victorian and the New South Wales trainers and owners appealed against this, but the committee wouldn't go back. So all the New South Wales trainers and owners withdrew their horses from that race, and there was only seven horses ran in the 1863 Melbourne Cup. And it was won by a Victorian, obviously, yeah.
That was the year of the banker, I think it was, at 10-1. Was it the banker who won the race?
I'm not sure.
I think it might have been, yeah. The Victoria Racing Club was formed 1 year after that, 64.
Yeah.
So we can say to the chairman, you don't have to take the blame.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary story, and five cups in 18 years.
Yeah, well, after the 1863 adventure, he said he'd never race there again, but he did come back and won three more. Yeah.
Tim Whiffler, we heard Andrew
Whiffler,
talking about
Canamaya,
two Tim Whifflers, yeah.
Yeah.
So why, well, coming from interstate, he prepared Tim Whiffler, Sydney Tim.
Yeah. As against Melbourne Tim, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Johnny Letts, in 1972, you came to Flemington for the first time to take a ride in the Melbourne Cup.
I'd never been over the border, Brian, from South Australia. And, in 1968, I rode the Great Lorraine Lover in the Adelaide Cup, and I was going to ride him in the Melbourne Cup, I thought. Graham Higney, who trained the horse, said after the race, you'll ride him in the Melbourne Cup. Now, a jockey's dream is to win a Melbourne Cup. Mine was to ride in it. And, of course, we lost the horse to Mickey Ravens, and Jimmy Johnson was Mickey's rider. And I had to watch him from Balaclava that day, and he won the Melbourne Cup by 8 lengths. And a year later, just to make me feel good, he won it again. And then I thought, this will never happen to me. I've had an opportunity. Sometimes in your life you think you get one opportunity and it's gone. I thought, it'll never happen. 72, I get a phone call from George Hanlon, a friend of his, to ride the horse, and because at that stage I'd given up more or less riding in the Melbourne Cup, and the phone call was on a Wednesday morning, which was 6 days before the Melbourne Cup, and the phone call went something like, is that John Letts? I said yes, and I was just going to the Gawler races, and the guy at the other end said, have you got to ride in the Melbourne Cup next Tuesday? And then I started to think, you know, which ones of my mates go out Tuesday night and drink? And I really could have lost the ride in the Melbourne Cup, because I said, my answer was, look, I haven't taken one at the moment, but I'm waiting on Bart Cummings, Colin Hayes, or Tommy Smith to ring me. And the guy said, oh, well, I'm ringing up for George Hanlon, and he's got a horse called Piping Lane in the Melbourne Cup. And I said, what weight's he got? He said, 48 kilos. And I had to struggle to ride the weight. But I thought, this is my chance to ride in it. I didn't know that he was an 80-1. I'd never heard of Piping Lane. And I said, I'll be there next week to ride him in the Melbourne Cup. So I went over on Sunday and I thought, I'll have a look at Flemington Monday. And I slept in. So I thought, I better go and have a look Tuesday, because I'm riding there in the afternoon. And I actually slept in again. So then I went to the races, and I said to the young girl at the motel, could you get me a cab to get the races, please? She said, you won't get a cab today, and this was a year of 110,000 people. So luckily for me, my brother was in Melbourne playing golf. And I left a message with him. I said, you better pick me up and take me to the races. I've got to ride in the Melbourne Cup. I said, I can't get there. So he came round and he picked me up, and nothing had gone right at this stage towards this ride in the Melbourne Cup, because on a Saturday night, just going back a couple of nights, I went on a TV program and the guy said, you've got to ride in the Melbourne Cup, which was a big deal for an Adelaide jockey to get a ride in the Melbourne Cup. And he sat me down and he said, straight to air, he said, I'll just ask you a few questions. He said, you're riding in the Melbourne Cup Tuesday, John? I said, yes. He said, you excited? I said, yes. He said, you know the horse? I said, I know everything about him. I've watched all his form. I've watched the replays. I've seen all the tapes on him. I've done everything. I know everything about him. He said, what's his name? And I said, Palace Lane? He said, you mean Piping Lane? I said, yeah, that's the one. So, you know, the stories that come out of Melbourne Cups. I got to the races and, you know, Flemington, I'd never experienced anything like that in my life. 110,000 people, and the most I'd ridden in front of was 20. So we pull in the gate, my brother pulls in, and, you know, it's Melbourne Cup day, and you drive into the members and you drop people off and you drive out again like out of a horseshoe. My brother dropped me off and I got out the car, and I'll never forget this. I had my suit on, I had a saddle on this arm, I had my race bag in this hand. I went to the members' gate. I was that high, and I went to walk through the gate, and the guy there, you know, one day of the year that they get the white coat and the sheriff's badge, and the guy said, what do you want? Now, I was the size of a pygmy. I had a saddle on this arm. I had a race bag full of gear this hand, and it was Melbourne Cup Day. And I said, I'm the plumber. And I thought I'd be smart, and he was smarter. He said, the plumber's gate's down there. So I walked into the room, and you can imagine you walk into a room as big as this at Flemington, and there's Roy Higgins, Harry White, you know, Pat Hyland, and there's Midge Didham, the Skelton boys. They were all there. And I thought, what am I doing here? I'm on an 80-to-1 chance or a 100-to-1 chance. I've got no chance in the race. And there's a story out of the Melbourne Cup, but just cutting that very short, I went out into the mounting yard, and I'd never met George Hanlon. And I didn't meet the owner. This is before the race. And he had four runners, George. And I went out in the mounting yard. I got no instructions, nothing. And I went over. I met Piping Lane 10 minutes before the race. I'd never seen him again, ever. The sad part of that for me was we had a reunion something like 28 years later. And I went to Hobart to see him again, Launceston to see him again. And I got there the day after he died. And, you know, it was going to be the reunion because, to me, he was my path in life. I never had the chance to thank him because, as you know, after with the presentation, the horse walks, the jockey walks. The presentations are there. I never, ever had the chance to thank him. When I went to get on him in the mounting yard, I'd never met the connections, nothing, no nothing. And when I went to get legged up, I said to the young girl that was leading the horse around, I said, where do you ride this horse? You know, front, back, side, wherever. She said, I don't know. She said, but you better ride him properly. I was sitting in the gates, and I'll never forget, and Neville Voigt was sitting alongside me on a horse called Hayburner. And I went out in the race, and I'd spoken this story I've told. Can I tell the story, the Chiquita Lodge story when I...
Absolutely, yes.
So what happened is, before I went out in the race, I spoke to Harry White. And I said to Harry, where do you make your run at Flemington, Harry? Because I knew Harry had come to Adelaide and Roy had come to Adelaide, Higgins. And Harry said, jump him out the gate, son. He said, when you put him to sleep, when you get to Chiquita Lodge, get into the race. That's where we all get serious. And I thought, Chiquita Lodge, yep. Plan A. Now, Chiquita Lodge, I didn't know, was a racing stable on the outside of Flemington. And I thought Chiquita Lodge would be a 30-storey high, big, tall lodge, like a motel, with a big sign on the top that said, Chiquita Lodge. So I went out into the race, and I think, plan A, right, I'll go to Chiquita Lodge, go to sleep, like Harry said, go to sleep, get round to Chiquita Lodge, get into the race. Now, it's a racing stable at 1,000 metres at Flemington. So I get down to the barrier, and I'm thinking, there's 24 of us in it. And I hadn't done a lot of studying on the race because I didn't think I had much chance. And I was sitting in the gate And I thought, you know, I ought to have another plan in case the first one doesn't work. That's a long way to go before anything happens. So I might have it, put that to plan B and I'll have plan A. And I was sitting in the gate alongside Neville Voigt, who was on a horse called Hayburn, a stablemate. And 110,000 people out there. And I said to Neville, I said, what do you think? Because I didn't know Neville. He was from Sydney. And he said, not much. I said, you got a chance? He said, no. And I said, these are stablemates. You know, conversation nerves, I suppose. And I said, you got a chance? He said, no. I said, these are stablemates. He said, nor is yours. No chance. And now all of a sudden I felt really confident, you know. So I was sitting there and I had Higgs winning alongside me on Guns End, and he was the only grey horse in the race. He drew 10 and I drew 11. And I thought, you know, Roy's been around. He's won a couple of these. Plan A might be I follow Guns End. Well, he's the only grey in the race. And I thought, I can't miss him unless, of course, the Clark of the Course joins in and then, you know, and then there's a couple of them. So we're sitting in the gate and we're ready to go, and I'll never forget talking to one of the jockeys, the American jockeys, and he described to me about the Kentucky Derby, you hit the wall when you jump out the barrier, and you also hit that wall when you turn for home again. And I was sitting in the gate there and I thought, wherever you go, Higgs, I'll be right on your back, one step behind you. And we jumped out the barrier and the wall was there, whoosh. And for the first time in his life, Gunsin missed the jump. And I was in front of him. And I thought, well, if Higgins is going to follow me, he's in for a shock. Because I actually don't know where I'm going. So anyway, we went down the straight the first time, and I go out the straight, and I'm thinking, Chiquita Lodge, Chiquita Lodge, Chiquita Lodge. No, it's not there at the 2000, it's not there at the 1600, it's not there at the 1400, it's not there at the 1200. I thought, you know, they must have pulled it down last night, this year. We get to the 1,000 metres, and all of a sudden, whoosh, right alongside me, there's the old grey head. Gunsind, I thought, Higgs is off, so am I. And you know, there was about 12 jockeys in the race were following Higgins. But the things that you never ever forget in your life is when Roy went, I went, and so did all the others. Because they were following the champ, they were following Higgs. We turned for home and I was running 11th, and there was 22 in the race, or 12th, and I thought, you know, my first ride in the Melbourne Cup might be my last, but I'm going to beat half of them home. I've got something to remember. And, you know, at the top of the straight, I thought that. Then I got down a little bit closer. I started 11th, 10th, 9th, 8th, 7th. And when you don't know the place, I didn't know Flemington. I thought, I know it, the winning post is right down there. And I'm starting to pass a few of these blokes, you know. And I get down, and I get down with 100 metres to go, and there was a mare in the race called Magnifique. And the favourite, Brucey Marsh rode her. And, you know, something else that never left my mind is a memory that will never leave my mind, and it was what I thought, and excuse me for saying this, but I thought, fall over, you bitch. And she slowed up. So I went on and won the Melbourne Cup. And I went over the line and I thought, I've won a race at Flemington, New Beauty. And Harry White come up, he hit me on the back, he said, good luck to your son, you've won the Melbourne Cup. And I thought, I've won the Melbourne Cup. And I just couldn't believe it. I went out on the track not knowing anybody. And like Wendy said, with the fathers, I come back and I had that many fathers along the fence and mothers, and they were all there. And they got there within 3 minutes. But I went back in and, you know, you're it. And as you can recall, Brian, you were with me till 5 that next morning. And I went back in and I'm sitting down, and one of the greats of Australian racing was a guy named Billy Cook. And Billy came up to me and he said something which has stuck in my mind forever. He said, son, this is the day in your life everything is going to change. From today. And I thought, you know, it's the Melbourne Cup, it's another race. But I didn't realise the impact that it would have on your life. And I was sitting in there and I put my suit on. And I get ready to go out and the stewards, intercom. Jay, let's the stewards room, please. I thought, you know, even the stewards over here are nice. They're going to congratulate me on my ride. They must do that here. So they took me into the room and they said, Jay, let's you rode Piping Lane in the Melbourne Cup. Well, I knew I had. So I thought, well, I'll get one right. So I said, yes, sir, I did. And he said, "Your whip action." So I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You hit him in front of the saddle." I said, "That's right." They said, "Don't you realise that you're not allowed to hit him in front of the saddle in Victoria?" And I said, "Well, no, sir. As a matter of fact, I didn't." And he said, "Well," he said, "we're either going to fine or suspend you." I said, "Thank you, sir." So they send you out. They only send you out for a little while. And I went outside and they took me back in again after about 30 seconds. I said, "Jay, can you give us a reason for hitting him there in front of the saddle?" I said, "No, sir, I can't." And they said, "Well, it's going to be a fine or a suspension. You can't give us a reason. Wait outside." So that was the second time. They took me in the third time. "You can't give us a reason." I said, "No, sir, I cannot give you a reason." He said, "OK, we're going to pass sentence." Out. Back in again the fourth time. And when I went in, I thought, they've given me so many opportunities to give them a reason. I better give them one. And when I went back in, they said, "Well, it's either going to be a fine or a suspension. You can't give us a reason." I said, "Excuse me, gentlemen." And I thought, well, they would never have been called that before. And I thought, that will help me a little bit. I said, "Put yourself in my position." I said, "There's 110,000 people out there today." I said, "I got to the front at the 100 metres. I said, I was going to hit that old B. I won't swear now, but I did there. I said, I was going to hit that old B wherever he had hair." And they said, "Wait outside." So I came back in and they said, "Jay, let's under rule LR48 or whatever, we're fining you $100. I said, "Thank you, sir." They said, "That's not for hitting me in front of the saddle. That's for swearing in the steward's room." That was my introduction to Melbourne racing. But it wasn't a bad introduction.
Fantastic introduction. John just touched Sheila on his life changed forever, winning on Piping Lane. And we'll talk about Belldale Ball a little bit later. What did it do to you in that day in 2001?
Oh, it's just amazing how recognised you are wherever you go. And I had a bit of trouble. I know on the Thursday I said I'd go shopping for my daughter because she'd been bad at school and wasn't allowed to come to the Cup to watch. That's another story. I'd done afternoon stables, gone back to the place where I was staying, and they'd gone out and I hadn't got a key to get in, so I just went in my scruffy stable gear. Ended up in Chadstone shopping mall, and the people there that were just following me around wanting autographs, and I was just mortified because I looked so scruffy. And on the way out, then we went past a shop that sold wigs, so we grabbed a blonde wig and I wore that for quite a long time until I managed to accommodate myself and sort of... the reception you get from people is just amazing. And if you've never been used to having that... Well, you would have found the same, Wendy. Whenever you go anywhere, they know who you are. And from being Miss Nobody to somebody who's recognised everywhere they went, not so much now, thank goodness, but then it was quite difficult to get used to, I must say.
It seems to be the only sport, Wendy, that does this, you know, that gives you this sort of star status, but it's something that stays with you. And people, it's as though people want to be a part of it with you.
A bit like Mr. Letts over here. I really just wanted to get the horse to Melbourne and race in the Cup. But you say that it's probably the only sport. I actually won a trophy once for 10-pin bowling. And I have to agree with you, I didn't get the same recognition.
I've got to ask you... how in the hell did you come up with a name like Rogan Josh? It's something off an Indian menu. Why didn't you call it Tandoori Chicken? Or, you know,
we tried.
Did you?
Yeah. We were going to try. We had to put three names in, and I didn't realise then that you could ring the board and say, "Is this name taken and can I have this name?" So, yes, Tandoori Trader was the name we submitted along with Vindaloo and Rogan Josh. So we were really onto the curries and really onto the spices, but Rogan Josh's mother was a horse called Eastern Mystique, and the sire was Old Spice. And, you know, we thought about Posh Spice and Victoria Beckham and all those names, and we sort of realised that probably we couldn't name it after a real person. So we thought the curry counter in Coles. And so we went off to the spice rack at Coles, and there were some fabulous names there. You know, I can't believe that everyone doesn't do this. And it was a purple packet, and probably you know, people who are superstitious and do have dreams tend to win Melbourne Cups. And being very superstitious, I liked the purple packet, which was Rogan Josh. And so that was the third name. And the powers that would be said, you can call him Rogan Josh.
So how did the Bart Cummings come into the equation? Was it after the run in the Perth Cup?
It was indeed, but there's a, you know, like a long history of always of getting to a Melbourne Cup. And I think I heard this morning the quote that racing has long been a misogynist sport and women haven't had a role in racing. And that's very true. And I come from a family of bushies, really, who have had a long association with horses. And girls in my family really didn't race horses and didn't have much to do with it. And ironically, and my mother, and this is one for the history books, Andrew, is ostensibly the great-granddaughter of Jack Riley. She is the great-granddaughter, who was ostensibly the man from Snowy River. My father never believed this because it meant that a woman might be connected with horses, and, you know, we had other roles in life. So by the time we... I got the horse. I had that dream that, well, we've got this horse. Obviously, anyone who gets a horse must have a chance at winning a Melbourne Cup. I think that everyone believes that. That is the belief. That is the reality, isn't it? And having fought with my brother over ownership, once he realised the horse might be good, I then wrestled him away and... I got him to Perth, to a trainer in Perth, and the Perth trainer was very good and very kind to us, and but more a man who said, well, you've got a good horse, have a lot of fun and, you know, pay the bills and come on Sunday and you can have a pat. So we call that pat and pay day. And after the Perth Cup, Bart Cummings was on the track that day, and we were beaten first up, beaten by a horse first up over 3,200 metres. It was a horse called King of Saxony, owned by the Miller family. And we were by far the best horse in the race. And we had an armed guard on our horse on the day because the first five favourites had armed guards, but the first up over 3,200 metres didn't have an armed guard and beat us. I was furious, I was devastated, I was heartbroken. And I said, I'm not racing in Western Australia anymore. And they said, oh, you can't take a horse across the Nullarbor to Melbourne. We don't do that. You know, I think there'd been Heron Bridge and one other somewhere that had done particularly good stuff. And I said, no, I'm taking him to Max Lee's in Newcastle. And they said, do you know Max Lee's? And I said, no, but I'm taking him to Max Lee's. Anyhow, they thought I'd really lost my marbles, and they said, look, you think you're going to win a Melbourne Cup, you've got a handy West Australian horse that's won a Bunbury Cup, why do you think that you can do this? I said, because I know it's true. And they said, well, look, we know someone who knows someone who worked in Bart Cummings' stable, who knows Bart Cummings' foreman. If we're going to go to the Eastern States, perhaps we could contact Bart Cummings. And I said, that's good. So no one knew Bart Cummings. No, well, I think we all knew him, but no one was game enough to ring him up. I don't think anyone knew how to genuflect. So anyhow, eventually through a whole chain of people, we got a message to Bart, and through Joe Agresta it was, and it came back through the stable back down to me. Bart would be delighted to have your horse. But, of course, I'd never spoke to Bart. I never had the opportunity to even speak to the stable, but we duly put him on a horse with some West Australian water, spelled him halfway across the Nullarbor, gave him a drink of water, and he got to Bart Cummings' stable. At that point, we lost track of him. We didn't know who to ring up, didn't know what questions to ask, didn't know where to go.
I bet you still got the bills.
Well, it was true. Someone said last night it's it was $105 a day, but $130 a day if I dared speak to him. Well, you know, I was working three jobs just to get to this point, and there was no way I was going to pay $130 a day. And it wasn't, and everyone, you know, is saying to me, you will be the laughing stock of West Australia if you do this. You cannot do these things in racing. And, of course, all the blokes were saying, you know, you can't give a woman a racehorse and expect her to know what to do. And it was quite a horrible situation. And eventually, Reg Fleming got to be a foreman at Bart Stables, and we got a phone call from him, and he said, Mr. Cummings has said that you should watch the race, not are you coming out to see the race? I think he wondered who we were. He said, you should win at Moonee Valley on Friday night. Oh, so we put the house on it. Came sixth. Anyhow, afterwards, Robert said, don't drink champagne tonight and don't ring the stable. He said, we'd like to make a good impression if we are going to contact Bart Cummings about racing. And I really was as wild as I was on Perth Cup Day. Anyhow, Robert went to bed, so I rang the stable. And Bart, of course, wasn't at Saintly Place that night. He was probably with the owner somewhere else that had won that night. And I said, well, I'm very disappointed in Mr. Cummings and I'm very disappointed in the stable, and I really, really think that, you know, it's about time I had a say in the direction of this horse. And they said, well, you've always had a say, you know, why haven't you run us? And I said, well, that's all right, you'll be hearing more from me. And the next morning, the phone rings, I'm getting ready to go to school. Hello? G'day, it's Bart here. And he said, something happened last night. I hear you rang the stable. He said, neighbours unhappy? No, I said. Throw stones on your roof? No, I said. He said, well, what, your neighbours don't know what we're doing in Melbourne and they're telling you that I'm not a good trainer? No, I said, no one would ever say that, Mr. Cummings. All right, he said, I don't know what went wrong. He's eaten up today. He's a good handy horse. He said, I think I can do something with him. And he said, I'll be in Darwin next week. I'll meet you. And the next week, he turns up, we turn up, and we decide to take him out for dinner. And we arrange to meet him. And he says, oh, have you got a boat? And I thought, a boat? And, of course, we didn't have a boat. And I said, oh, yeah, yeah, we have, I said. He said, oh, how big is it? I said, oh, just one of those little tinnies. So it was a long story and a long way to Bart Cummings' stable. But after the dinner that night, this was just after the Darwin Cup, just before racing got serious down here in the eastern states in Victoria, he left, and with a wink and a smile, he said, I think we've got the toast of the spring carnival in my stable. And that was a long way out. And I think we were 363 at that stage and the list of nominations. So it was a big deal.
What about on the day? He'd won the McKinnon Stakes on the Saturday at Wait for Age, so he dropped about 8 kilos, I think, from 58 to 50, was it?
That's 51 he started,
yeah,
I think.
So he dropped 7 kilos. What did Bart say to you about his chances on Cup Day?
He's never going to be beaten. And
did you put the house on him?
I had a good bet on the Saturday on the Wait for Age because he started at 16 to 1. And that was a phenomenal race. And I think it was Joe, the track rider, who said that when he had got on him on the Monday, it was like hopping out of a mini minor and suddenly discover that you were driving something with a V8 motor. And he said too, we're never going to be beaten. And of course then all the tactics of how you're going to ride him and, you know, Bart's ride him from behind. The jockeys tend to sort of have a different idea. And I remember Bart said to Jay Marshall when he legged him up, he said, Johnny, you ride him like an old-fashioned stayer. He said, you don't touch him until you get to the clock tower, which is about 200 metres out. And he said, as soon as you hit that clock tower, he said, you're into him. So that might be a riding whip breechment there. And I remember he took him to the front, very roughly ridden race, got right across in front of this mad field, the whole field just about come down at the 200 metre mark after they jumped. And there we were behind the Sheik's horse, Central Park, and Frankie Dettori's on the second seed from the from the Sheik stable, and we sat behind him most of the way. And we get to about 600 out, and the whole field's coming over him, and Johnny's sitting there, he's not moving. And Central Park, yeah, what an incredible ride that horse put in that day. And I said to her, oh, John, hit him, you know, really get into him, get him up there, get him up there. And, you know, you're riding the race. And he sat there and he sat there, and the whole field, we were fourth, we were fifth, we were fourth, we were fifth, and all these other horses that we were terrified of are now taking our running. And he hit the clock tower, and out come the whip, and John's a left-hander, and the horse tended to lug, so he lugged the right way, and he and the call started, and it's Central Park, Rogan Josh, Central Park, Rogan Josh, and it was Rogan Josh Bart's got his 11th Melbourne Cup. And if ever a race was planned, if a race was ridden to the best of someone's ability, Jay Marshall has to be given the credit of sitting quietly, of riding how he was instructed. And if ever you were to say, how does a magician know how to bring to fruition a dream, it was that day. And that is really, for me, what Bart Cummings was all about, and what racing was all about, and what the Melbourne Cup was all about. Because that day, we were the underdog, the welter horse from Perth. The Friedman commentator who was on the Sky Racing Channel said he'd race naked down Collins Street if we won. He's never done it. You know, and you think, what have I done? And you've just got to believe. And I remember I said on the microphone that day, that makes me Wendy in Wonderland. And I wish I was back in the staff room at my school, because that was the moment that I was overwhelmed, and I knew what they would be thinking out there, away from it all, in a little classroom, saying, this is what magic's about.
Wendy, you've taken on a role as an ambassador now with the Melbourne Cup winner tours. You've been to London and Los Angeles, is that right?
And Dublin.
And Dublin.
Yes, I've been to Dubai and Auckland. I've been to New York and Boston. I've been pretty lucky, haven't
telling,
I?
Telling the story, and you obviously love telling the story. It's what sort of reaction do you see when you talk to people in foreign countries about, you know, something that you're so close to, and we all are close to, but what's the general reaction you get?
It's really, really incredible, and I can't tell you why we get the reaction we do in Dublin this year. There was a wonderful, wonderful audience of fantastic racing people, fantastic barons of industry, and, you know, marketing people, tourism people. And I tell the story, you know, about the journey home through the centre of Australia. I talk a lot about the christening of the baby and how people interpret the cup. And even the toughest of racing men will stand up and clap after they hear our story, and they all say in the same total bewilderment with which I tell the story, they come back and say, what an incredible story, what an incredible statement a nation is making to itself, and what a wonderful, wonderful story it is for us as horsemen to be able to live that dream with you.
Very true. Mark, what sort of memories do you have of your grandfather, and what stories have been passed down from his, you know, great success?
Because he was 29 when he won the first World Cup, and he died in 1916, and I was born in 1941, so there was no memories at all, but I was indoctrinated right from a very early age on the Melbourne Cup and how important it was to the family. And over the years, because I was a farmer, and with all the shearers, and they'd walk on the property and they'd sort of say, oh, Domester, Archer. So I could have probably been called Archer, it would have been the same thing. But, no, it was really sort of brought into us. But very fortunately for me, Rod Fitzroy and Joe McGrath asked me to participate in the Melbourne Cup tours. And I've got to learn so much more about the Melbourne Cup and the history and the feeling and the emotion and the excitement, and it's been absolutely wonderful, and it'll carry on with my two boys too.
Are you still on the property, or are you still in that
same
area?
Oh, I've retired, yeah.
Is that Shoalhaven?
Pardon?
Whereabouts is that?
The properties? Yeah, one at Bungendore and one at Jass.
And Etienne de Mestre established a stud farm and a racing training track at Shoalhaven, is that correct?
Well, that was the original grant of land that was his father got. Prosper de Mestre was given the 1,280 acres on the southern side of the Shoalhaven River. Alexander Berry, who was on the north side of the town Berry, and they had that, and Etienne was the third son of Prosper. I can't remember how many children there, 12 or 11. And one of them died quite early. Young Prosper died quite early. And Etienne stayed on there with his mother, and he was keen on racehorses, from a very, very early age, and became quite a master at it. And he got involved with Tom Roberts from Braidwood, who was a great breeder of horses, and there was a syndicate up there called Hassel, Royds and Roberts that bred a lot of the horses that Etienne trained. And so that was a great association. And that's where all the Melbourne Cups are. They went back to the Royds family, they are now all in the vault of the Bank of New South Wales or Westpac in Martin Place in Sydney. But then I quite often get asked about, what was the trophy from the first Melbourne Cup? Well, it was a gold watch, and no one knows where that went. No one could talk about that. Yeah.
John, 1980, Belldale Ball, Colin Hayes, you pursued that ride. You were pretty keen to ride that horse in that cup that year.
I actually watched Belldale Ball run in the Moonee Valley Cup, and Roy rode him, Higgs rode him, and I rode a horse for Colin Hayes in the race. She was walking around before the start in the mounting yard and with the rubber grip on the bottom, and she moved the plate and put a nail into her hoof, and the vet was going to scratch her, and Colin was there, and he said, look, why don't you let John take her to the barrier? If she's lame, scratch her. If she's not, let her run. So we got round to the barrier and she was okay. So sometimes it's fate that brings you into these Melbourne Cups. I was following the two leaders, and one of them was Belldale Ball outside the leader. And I didn't know Belldale Ball at all. I know he won a race in South Australia at a country meeting, but he'd also won a race in England. And he was raced by Robert Sangster. And when I came in after the race, the horse that I rode, I must have been pretty spot on with it not being lame because it ran last. And when I came in after the race, CS was there and he said, what happened? I said, well, she's not lame. I said, but something's not right. And I said, I don't think she's up to this class. And I said, what was that horse you had in the race outside the leader? He said, he's a horse called Belldale Ball. And I said, is he in the Melbourne Cup? And he said, yeah. I said, I'd like to ride him. He said, I've got a horse that's won 4 or 5 straight in Adelaide called Gay Trebo. He said, he's pretty good. He said, no, I think he can win the Melbourne Cup. He said, ride him. I said, no. I said, I want to ride that horse. He said, he's won a welter at Balaclava or somewhere. I said, I just felt something about him. So he rang me the next morning and he said, take your pick. I said, Belldale Ball. He said, OK, you're on him, but you picked the wrong one. So then I spoke to Roy Higgins a week later, and I was in the jocks room at Flemington or Caulfield or somewhere, and I said to Higgs, I said, I took the ride on that horse in the Melbourne Cup. I said, he's only got 49 kilos and Roy couldn't ride under 55 or something. He said, he's not much good. I said, something's just telling me to ride him. So on the Saturday, I rode him in the Dalgetty, and I was in the mounting yard, and I'd ridden winners for Robert Sangster in Adelaide, but I'd never met him. And we were standing there with Colin Hayes, and he had a horse in called Bohemian Grove, and Mickey Mallion rode him. And we were standing there together, and Robert Sangster said to me, he said, I'd love to win this race. I said, so would I. And he said, no, my other horse, Bohemian Grove. I said, well, fair enough. So we went out in the race, and, of course, Bohemian Grove won the race, and I ran second. And when we came in after the race, everyone, because they all go to the winner. No one came to me, and I was just walking in. Robert Sanks had come past as I was walking back to weigh in, and he said, "What do you think?" I said, "You win the Melbourne Cup Tuesday." He said, "Yeah." He said, "He won easy today, didn't he?" And I said, "No, not him, not that one." I said, "This one." He said, "You think you can beat him?" I said, "That horse will never beat him again, ever in his life." And he said, "Are you fair dinkum?" I said, "I am." So we went upstairs to the barrier draw. And, of course, a couple of the press guys had heard me say this. And when we went upstairs, we drew barrier 24. And because when I'm walking away, the press guys are all there, and they said, "Oh, a bit of pressure on you now, Letzie. You've declared this to Sangster. You've drawn 24. I said, "There is no pressure on me at all." I said, "Because if it gets beat, I'll blame the barrier." So I went out with a clear mind, and I was in the mounting yard before the race, and CS was there with Robert Sangster, and I said, "How do you want me to ride him, CS?" He said, "You're telling me he's all right, do what you want him." I said, "Fair enough," which I appreciated, because he knew I liked the horse. Now, he was a 5-year-old stallion, very well-bred horse. And so I went down to the gate, and away we went, and I led for the last 2,000 metres. So anyway, when we come in after the race, they were all there, and they all said, "You know, you were right." I said, "Yeah." And the press guys, as you know, they were waiting for you to... And when I came out after, I said, "Can we have you straight away?" I said, "Yeah." So I came out, and they said, "How did you get that thing to run 2 miles? I said, "I psyched him into it." They said, "You psyched him into it?" I said, "Yep." I said, "This horse," I said, "won a race in England." I said, "He loved Ascot." I said, "On the way to the barrier, I sang 'God Save the Queen' to this horse." I said, "He thought he was back in England." And, of course, these guys start thinking, "Is this true?" And they said, "That did it." I said, "No." I said, "We were walking around behind the barrier." I said, "You are a very lucky horse." I said, "We've drawn gate 24. We're last to go in." I said, "You know," I said, "next year," I said, "your owner is the richest owner in the world with a lot of stud farms. You're a 5-year-old stallion." I said, "The first Tuesday in November next year, we'll all be back here. But if you win the race, you won't." I said, "And guess what you'll be doing?" They said, "That did it." I said, "No." I said, as we walked in, I patted him and I said, "Now, don't be nervous." I said, "Just what I told you back there," I said, "I don't want you to be nervous." I said, "But the 3 guys standing there as they legged me up was Colin Hayes, Robert Sankster, your owner," I said, "and the veterinary surgeon." "Your name's Bill Dale Ball?" I said, "All I heard him say, well, I've had a good wager on this. The vet told Colin and Robert, I've had a good bet on this horse. If he doesn't win, I'll be round in the morning. It'll be just Bill Dale." I said, "You'd run fast for 2 miles, wouldn't you?" It wasn't true, but they didn't believe me anyway. But I thought I'd throw something like that.
Johnny, you retired in 1988, had 2,350 winners and a stunning career in racing, but you've taken on a new role, and not only as an ambassador for the Melbourne Cup, but you're coming up to your 17th year as virtually the outrider, the guy who is the first on horseback to go to the jockey who wins the Melbourne Cup. And the same horse, Banjo, for the 17 years this year. You're first to greet, you know, the jockeys. First to Damien Oliver in 2002. First to John Marshall with Rogue and Josh. You know, that's an extraordinary role to have.
Some wonderful stories, Brian, out of the Melbourne Cup. And, of course, you know, the Emirates Melbourne Cup every year. And, you know, I look at it this way. When I go out to interview the jockey, I know how it's going to change his life. I know how he's going to change. Because, except if you're Glenn Boss, which you've won 3, or Damien's won a couple, after the first one you realise it. But some of those jockeys don't realise how it's going to change their life. I always put it in the comparison of when I was a jockey in Adelaide, I was successful, but I always compare it with sitting in a room with a lot of doors of opportunity. And they were never going to open. And, you know, when I won it in 72, the doors started to open. because a year later I was in Africa, America, Canada, all around the world. That would never have happened if I hadn't won the Melbourne Cup. And I think to myself how lucky I was, you know, that it happened to me. There's a lot of people you want to thank, you know. At the age of 14, my teacher suggested I leave school. That is another story. But he said to me, why don't you try to become a jockey? And I was 13 at the time. And I thought, at that stage, I thought, well, they must be small and dumb. Because I was. And I said, well, Mr. Manning, why do you think I should become a jockey? He said, well, in those days, they used to do 3 tests a year and they'd have the exams. And we would sit at a desk with a little briefcase between us. And I said, look, I'd like to get my intermediate. I said, I've never been near a horse at 13. And he said, look, he said, I tell you what I'll do. He said, you try to become a jockey. So I said, okay. So they did the exams and we got down. He said, when's your birthday? I said, July. He said, did you turn 14 then? I said, yes. He said, we have exams in September. He said, so I would be looking for a job in July before the exams in September. And I said, well, you know, I thought I got through and you get your little exam, your report card, exam, report card. And I said, all my subjects, I got an F. And I said, well, Mr. Manning, I said, really? I said, I got an F in every subject. He said, I know. And I said, well, that's fair, isn't it? He said, it doesn't go down any further. And he said, and what really worried me, he said, and I really feel that you should become a jockey, he said, because he said, the kid alongside you, the lad that sits alongside, I said, he said, he's very smart. I said, he's top of the class, every exam, he goes top. Now, I'm sitting there and we've got a case between us. I'm sitting here, he's sitting there. He said, I took home the exams. He said, and I marked them all. He said, and one question and answer really worried me. I said, what was that? He said, well, do you know how smart he is? I said, yes. He said, the question was, who discovered Australian watch and watch, whatever, and he'd put down, I don't know. And he said, and your answer to the same question was, I don't know either. So it was time to leave.
I bet it was too. Just going back to going up alongside the winning rider of the Melbourne Cup. So you've been there with Johnny, with Damien Oliver, with Jim Cassidy, with Mick Kanaan back in 1993. Now, what happened in 2006? Because the two Japanese horses,
yes.
Delta Blues and
yes.
Pop Rock, hit the line together, Damien Oliver on Pop Rock. But a guy who couldn't speak a word of English was on the winner, Delta Blues, and you were going to be first up there for Channel 7. And the whole worldwide network wanted to hear from the winning rider. What did you do?
That was about the longest 17 days in my life because we had the Caulfield Cup. And I watched the form of the Caulfield Cup. And it's always a good form guide to the Emirates Melbourne Cup. And when they went over the line, I thought, Pop Rock? Delta Blues, the two Japanese horses, good runs. Eye Popper was a very good run when it came before. And I thought, the two chances. Now, I can't rehearse before the race because I don't know the winner. I don't see the race. I've been out there on the track now 17 years for the Melbourne Cup, but I never see it. I only hear it through the... And when they go over the line, I'm told down the line what won it. So I've got about 30 seconds to rack my brain to ask questions that I should... that people think you should know. But we've got through it so far. When those two horses were in the Melbourne Cup, I thought, okay, Nash Ruwilla, Delta Blues. Nash is easy. Damien, old stager at the game, easy. Pop Rock, Delta Blues. Frankie Dettori, got to ride in the race. Frankie speaks English, no worries. So anyway, the week before, there's a jockey change. I Water on Delta Blues. I thought, oh no, he can't speak a word of English. This guy. So before the race, we've got the two horses that I did give chances. Damien was on one and Iwata was on the other. And I said to the guys in the Channel 7 studio, I said, now listen, fellas, I said, there's a bit of a problem here. I said, I can't speak a word of Japanese. And if this Japanese jockey wins, he can't speak a word of English. I said, what are we going to do? And they said, well, none of us know any Japanese. And there was one guy there did. And he said, I do. And I said, what is it? And he said, sayonara and konnichiwa. I said, what's that? He said, hello and goodbye. I said, what order? He said, that I don't know. So I wrote the two bits down and put in my jacket pocket. And, you know, and I'll never forget it because Greg Miles, I'm sure he knew that I couldn't speak Japanese. Because they get down to the 100 metres, I'm sitting around behind there, and Greg calls the race something like, he said, and the Japanese horses are going to fight out the Emirates Melbourne Cup. It's Pop Rock, Delta Blues. Ollie's pulled the stick on Pop Rock. He's gone up to join Delta Blues. I think, please, Damien, give it one extra one. You know? And then starting to think, and I thought very quickly, because you have to think quickly because they're not far to go, and I thought, oh, OK, if Damien wins it, OK, he's won it for Ireland, he's won it for Australia, now it'll be Japan. It'll never be done again. And then they gave a line, he said, Japan's won the Melbourne Cup. I thought, you beauty, good on you, Damien. And they come around the corner. And the guys up in the studio said, number three or number two, Delta Blues has won the Melbourne Cup, let's see the Japanese jockey. I thought, oh, no. So I went over and I canter up to him. Now, they don't do that in Japan like we do it here with the interviews, and because I've got a black microphone, and I canter up to Iwata, and he's pulling up, and he doesn't realise that he's actually won the Melbourne Cup. Damien hit him on the back, but I don't know whether he thought Damien hit him or punched him or whatever, but we're pulling up, and I race over to him, and I said, winner, and he just put his hand up, and he said, winner. And I thought, what am I going to say now? I said, happy? He said, happy. And then I went to say something else in broken English, and he turned around, he took off, he said, super horse. And he took off, and I thought, wow. And that year we had 800 million viewers around the world. And I said to the guys back in the studio, I said, what am I going to do now? And one of my producers, pretty smart, he said, go and get Damien and ask him how unlucky he was. He said he ran second. So anyway, we went back in there and I spoke to Damien after and I went back in the jocks room after and I said to Damien, I said, that was incredible, Damien. I said, you know, I spoke two words. I said, the shortest interview ever. And I said, what do you reckon? Like, he doesn't know any. He said, he knows nothing. He said, what I think was, he said, when you went up to him with that microphone, he thought it was a gun. Well, he might have. And he just... super. And that, we did 17 interviews the next day around the world, even to Tokyo, for two words. Winner and happy. So, you know, it was just incredible how that happened. And of course, you know, you talk about some of the first one, Michael Canane. Like, he came out here and you know, we had the Melbourne Cup. We'll say then, I think it was $1 million in 1993. I think $1 million. And Michael Canane comes back on Vintage Crop, and I'm waiting around the corner. It's our first year interviews. So he comes around, I canter up on the pony, and because you walk up and you never say to the jockey, how do you feel? Because you know the answer's going to be, he's not going to say, I feel terrible. You know, but I mean, you go up and you say, Michael, you've come all the way around the world and you've taken our biggest prize, $1 million race. He said, yeah. And that's all he said. And he took off. I thought, this is going to be the easiest job I ever had in my life. One word. You know, and he took off. And then I realised that he was riding in the Breeders' Cup, which was worth $1 million 2 days later. But, you know, there's been some fantastic stories out of, you know, the interviews. And, of course, Damien was one, which was just fantastic. And, you know, people talk to me and they say, how was the Damien Oliver interview? I said, look, I said, Damien, that was a very sad week for Damien. I said, tell you something about the Victorian public. I said, I went out on the track on a Saturday and I went out on a Tuesday with Damien. I said, and not one of those days, he was beaten on horses that were fancied, not one of those days did the public ever abuse him at all. They were all with him. And I said, we went out into the Melbourne Cup, and when we pulled up after the Melbourne Cup, I knew how he felt. Well, I hadn't been in that position, but I thought I knew how he would feel. And I said to him, look, Dame, I said, I know it's tough on you. And this is before we went to air. I said, I know it's tough on you. I said, but we're all with you. And that's how the interview went. And he was fantastic, you know. But you could have gone up with the questions that weren't right. But you went up with the right questions and it was fantastic, you know. And, of course, we went to, we had Maccabi Diva. I mean, the first year she won was, you think, oh, well, she's okay. And it's like Andrew said, how could a horse with the name like Maccabi Diva win the Melbourne Cup. She won the first year. She wins the second year, and you think, fabulous. The third year comes along, and before the race, we're called up into the stewards' room. When she wins today, which we hope, even the stewards want, everyone wanted her to win. They all went there that day. And when we went out, he said, there'll be, as soon as she goes over the line, if she wins, no one's to go near her, 200 security on the track, she'll come back and do a lap of honour in front of the crowd. So she goes down, and I didn't need to hear the broadcast of the race because I was around the back and I heard the crowd. And she came around the corner. Now, Glenn Boss went straight past me, and he went round to the 1400 at Flemington, which is nearly around again. So I hunted my old pony up and went after him. And I got up there, and I've never seen a jockey so emotional. He had his arms around her neck. He was just loving her. And I went up to him. I said, you know, mate, I said, this is the one, isn't it? And he said, I can't be interviewed. I said, why? He said, I can't. I just can't. I said, look, you've got plenty of time. The stewards told me to take as much time as you like with this interview. Well, actually, they hadn't. They said, hurry it up. But, I mean, we wasn't going to spoil it. So we got there, and then composure, and it was fantastic. Went back, and we all went to see that Emirates Melbourne Cup, and she delivered. And you know something? People say to me, you know, wouldn't it have been great if Honor June had, for South Australia, which I come from South Australia, had got up and beat her? It wouldn't have, because it would have been something that we'll never see in our lifetime again, a mayor winning 3 Melbourne Cups straight, and a great mayor. And, you know, I think it was fantastic that at the end of that line that Tony Sandick, the owner, said, that's it. Because she leaves us with memories that no horse has ever done, and we weren't here for Farlap, but she has left us with memories that will never, ever be erased in Melbourne Cup history. And that's something that we should be very, very proud of what she did.
Just before we wrap up, John, you've been working sort of in an ambassador role, particularly around through Australia. You've seen some fantastic sights. You've been to some remote areas. But you've told me so many tales about the cup and what joy it brings to people just to be able to touch it, to be photographed with it. It just continues to grow in stature.
Brian, there's some stories out of the Melbourne Cup, and, you know, one day I'm just going to sit down and I'm going to write some of them. There's just a couple of quick ones that I'd love to share with you, because we've had some sad ones, we've had some happy ones, and we've had some spooky ones, which Melbourne Cup stories are always... They've got so many stories. The Emirates Melbourne Cup has just got... It is just the dream. It's everyone dreams of it, and there's so many little things that people don't realise about the Melbourne Cup. But when I was in... it was Yarrawonga, and Joe McGrath was... Joe was over at the town hall, and he said, will you go over with Lauren and go through the hospital? Now, we give everybody a chance to see it. We don't just pick a ward and say, you're it. We go and we give everybody a chance in that ward to see it. And I went through that hospital, and we went along, and there was a nurses there, and I said, I walked past the ward, and there was a dear old lady. She was about 90, and she was sitting on the side of the bed in a chair. And I said, could I go? Because I always ask before I went in case, you know, it upset some people. And I went in and I said to the lady, they said, oh, look, she's very upset at the moment because we had to bring her in from her home, her unit. She's got a little puppy dog, her best mate, and there's no one to look after it, and we don't know how long she's going to be in here. She didn't know how long she's going to be in here. She said, we have got the results of her tests and she's going home tomorrow. I said, let me go in there first. So I went in with the Melbourne Cup, and the lady was sitting there. I said, hello. And she said, hello. I said, do you know what this is? She said, I think that's the Melbourne Cup. I said, it is. I said, and you know, this Melbourne Cup, I said, is magic. I said, it's changed so many people's lives. I said, I want you to hold the Melbourne Cup. I said, and make a wish. I knew what she was going to wish. She wanted to go home. And I said, I'll bet you this cup grants that wish. And she said, really? I said, it's magic. And she held the Melbourne Cup. When I walked out, I said, thank you very much. Don't tell me your wish. And I walked out and I said to the nurses, go in and tell her. So they went in and told her that she was going home tomorrow. Now, she believes that the Melbourne Cup is magic.
I went down the end. I went down the end to this young girl who just had a baby, 1 day old. This little fellow was 1 day old. And we went in, and there was a girl, I think her name was Debbie Ryan. And we went in, and I said, I walked in, and she was sitting alongside the bed. And I said, do you know what this trophy is? She said, no. She was about 24. And I said, it's the Melbourne Cup. She said, that's a horse race, isn't it? I said, yes. I said, the biggest in the world. I said, and this is the Emirates Melbourne Cup. And I said, I'd love you to have your photo taken with it. So we put the photo there, took the photo with it. And the little fella was 1 day old, this little fella. He was about this big, like a little rabbit. So I said, could we have his photo taken with the Melbourne Cup? And the nurse said, yes, certainly. So what we did, we laid the Melbourne Cup on a pillow on her bed. We put the little fella alongside it, and he was about 3/4 of the way up. And we just laid him there alongside it. And just as the guy was going to take the photo, I said, now put this on the back page of the sports tomorrow in your local paper. And just as he was going to take the photo, the little fella put his hand across onto the stem of the Melbourne Cup and held it. He went, click. And I said, put that on the front page. And I said to the young girl, I said, now look, I'd love to take down all the particulars, you know, your name and everything and that, because you're going to be in the paper tomorrow. She said, okay, my name is Debbie Ryan. I said, okay, Debbie Ryan. I said, now what is the little, your son's name? She said, Archer. His name was Archer Ryan. And that's a fact. I said, do you realise? I said, you've seen the Melbourne Cup. You know it. She said, no, I don't. And I said, I do not know anybody named Archer. Last name, yes. First name, no. And I said, that goes on the front page. Now, he was 1 day old. Our record at that stage was 3 months and 99 years of age in the one place in a hospital. Now, this little fellow was 1 day old and his name was Archer. And really, it was so spooky. We went up to Karratha very quickly and this was the sad one. We went in there and the girls were with me on the tour and we went in and this woman came in and she said, John, I'd love you to meet my husband. I said, certainly. And she took me into another room where he was and he was on drips and painkillers, comatised. And I went over and she said, look, he's been a fan of yours and the late Bill Collins. She said, and he'd love to meet you. So I took an Emirates Melbourne Cup cap in and I signed it to Tony, best wishes, John Letts. And I held his hand, and when I held his hand, he opened his eyes. And his wife said, Tony, John's here to say hello. And he was 52 years of age. And I just held his hand and she said, you've got your wish. She said, you know, John, she said, we're going to bury Tony in that cap next week because he'll be dead. And he wanted a little bit to do with the Melbourne Cup, the Emirates Melbourne Cup. But it made it. He died a week later. He died a week before the Melbourne Cup. But it was just something which was a sad part of the Melbourne Cup. But it was very sad for him, us. But it was just something in his, you know, his life before he died that he really wanted something. And that was just, he just opened his eyes and, you know, it's sad to think that that could happen, you know.
Thank you, John. We're about to take a break. We'll be coming back for the fourth session. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you'll agree that the stories, the tales are fantastic. Please thank Wendy Green, Sheila Laxon, Mark Demester and John Letts.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.